on VOA1, The Hits.
Welcome to Learning English, a daily 30-minute program from the Voice of America. I'm Jonathan Evans.
And I'm Ashley Thompson. This program is aimed at English learners, so we speak a little slower and we use words and phrases, especially written, for people learning English.
Today on the program, you will hear from Dan Friedel and Brian Len. Later, we will present our American history series, The Making of a Nation. But first, more than 10 years ago, the American technology company Apple began telling its smartphone users that if something was worth doing, there's an app for that. Now, there is an app for fighting terrorism. The U.S. National Counterterrorism Center recently launched its ActKnowledge mobile application, or app. It can be downloaded from Apple's App Store and from the NCTC website. The app is a one-stop shop to get unclassified counterterrorism information, one NCTC official said. The official did not want to be identified in order to discuss the center's move into mobile apps. Something that is a one-stop shop is something that enables people to do many different things in one place. Officials said a version should be available in the coming months from the Google Play App Store. The information will also be available in a version for personal computers. The app is being made available to the public. However, only counterterrorism professionals will be able to use all its features. NCTC officials said officials within the U.S. federal government and the U.S. military can use the app now. State and local counterterrorism officials will be able to use the app in the near future. This is a tremendous evolution of our information sharing efforts, a NCTC expert who helped develop the ActKnowledge app told reporters. We're moving from a weekly, regularized information sharing effort via email to a daily, near real-time effort, the expert said. Like other apps, NCTC's ActKnowledge will permit users to get notifications, search, and follow the latest news and information. The NCTC said the new mobile app will also permit the center to see what kind of information its government partners are looking for. In addition, the center will be able to make sure that information or training is made available. Officials are taking steps to protect the system from those who might try to misuse it. You're required to use your official government email address to register, a second NCTC expert said. That expert also did not want to be identified. The expert added that there is a system in place to make sure users are approved to receive the information. Officials said many of the app's features were designed with the help of police and fire departments from across the United States. Christy Abizade is the director of NCTC. She said in a statement, "With the release of ActKnowledge, NCTC is delivering on our mission to innovate how we share intelligence products with our partners." She added, "The app empowers its users with the information they need to protect their communities from potential threats."
Scientists from Argentina are working to understand more about microorganisms found in Antarctica that may be able to help clean up pollutants like plastic and diesel fuel. The scientists believe the very small organisms eat pollution left behind by fuel and possibly plastic waste. The study results could be useful for wider environmental issues. The scientists are working to find out if the organisms, bacteria and fungi native to Antarctica, can also work in warmer climates. The scientists found that the microorganisms can digest the waste created by diesel fuel, which is a common source of heat and electricity at research bases in Antarctica. Scientists have a reason for wanting to reduce pollution in Antarctica. The continent is protected by a rule created in 1961 that says it can be used for research only if it is left in good condition. Dr. Lucas Ruberto is a biochemist working on the study. He said the organisms that live in the Antarctic soil can eat and break apart hydrocarbon pollution. Ruberto and other scientists went to the Carlini research base in December. The team carried out tasks related to bioremediation, or returning something back to its natural state. They cleaned soil affected by diesel fuel by using native microorganisms and plants. The scientists found that the process, which can be used during Antarctica's warm season, removed 60 to 80% of pollutants in soil. Ruberto said the team helped the microbes by adding nitrogen, humidity, and airflow to improve soil conditions. Basically, with that, we get the microorganisms to biologically reduce, with a very low environmental impact, the level of contaminants, Ruberto told Reuters reporters. A contaminant is something that makes a substance no longer suitable for use. The scientists are now trying to research how the microbes could help clean up plastic waste in other places. Both fuels and plastics are polymers, molecules made up of mainly carbon and hydrogen. The researchers are looking into whether the microorganisms native to Antarctica can eat plastic waste. They are collecting pieces of plastic from Antarctic waters and looking to see if the microbes are degrading or breaking down the plastic. Nathalie Bernard is an expert in plastic biodegradation. She said, if we find that it is indeed degrading plastic, the next step would be to understand how it does that. The long-term goal, she added, is to create a process in which microorganisms can help clean up plastic and fuel pollution in other parts of the world. I'm Dan Friedel.
As the Winter Olympic Games continue in China, here are some of the different technologies being used in Beijing. A series of different kinds of robots have been deployed to assist visitors and athletes. Some machines are being used to enforce social distancing requirements related to COVID-19. Robots are also transporting equipment, cleaning surfaces, and preparing and carrying food to limit human-to-human contact. Smart waste containers are also being used, as well as machines that can make and serve alcoholic drinks and coffee. At the Winter Olympic Village, the athletes are sleeping on smart beds equipped with sensors. The devices collect information on things like breathing and heart rates. They also have controls to permit users to choose different sleeping positions, including one called zero gravity. That setting is supposed to reduce pressure on muscles and joints and support higher quality sleep. These high-tech beds are very different from the lower-tech versions provided for Olympic athletes at last year's Tokyo Games. The beds used in Japan, which received wide attention for being so unusual, were made of cardboard material for environmental reasons. Members of the media in Beijing can try out the same beds the athletes are using in special sleep-rest cabins. The cabins, or containers, permit reporters to enter and rest for up to an hour. The cabins are fully cleaned after each use. China's digital money will be in use at the Olympics in the currency's first major test with foreigners. Visitors will be able to use digital yuan to pay for food, transportation, and other goods and services. Users can get the currency by downloading an app, getting a digital yuan card, or by exchanging foreign currency into digital form through machines in Olympic areas. Over the past few years, China has carried out tests with digital money in major cities. The Chinese government has said that so far the digital currency has been used in about $13.8 billion worth of financial transactions. All Olympic attendees must use an app called My2022 for daily monitoring for COVID-19. The app permits users to send personal health information every day as a requirement to take part in the games. The system is part of China's aggressive effort to limit the spread of the virus during the games. But a Canadian organization that monitors internet security said in a report released last month that the My2022 app contains major security weaknesses. The security problems could lead to private user information being exposed, Toronto-based Citizen Lab said. This could include sensitive information such as passport details and medical and travel history, the group said. The report said the app does not effectively protect such information. This means it is possible it could be read by Chinese internet service providers or telecommunications companies through Wi-Fi hotspots at hotels, airports, and places holding Olympic competitions. The app also permits users to report politically sensitive content, Citizen Lab reported. and it includes a censorship keyword list. The group said the list can identify different political subjects, including Chinese policies in Xinjiang and Tibet, as well as naming government agencies. Because of security and privacy questions, cybersecurity company Internet 2.0 advised attendees to buy and take a new phone with them to use while in China. The company said this move can protect a user's personal information that is stored on their normal phone. Visitors were also urged to create a new email address and browser account on the temporary phone for use in China. I'm Brian Lin.
Welcome to The Making of a Nation, American History in VOA Special English. Americans experimented with many new customs and social traditions during the 1920s. There were new dances, new kinds of clothes, and some of the most imaginative art and writing ever produced in the United States. But in most ways, the 1920s were a conservative time in American life. Voters elected three conservative Republican presidents, Warren Harding, Calvin Coolidge, and Herbert Hoover. And they supported many conservative social and political policies. Kay Gallant and Harry Monroe continue the story of American conservatism during the 1920s.
One such policy concerned immigration. Most Americans in the 1920s had at least some ties through blood or marriage to the first Americans who came from Britain. Many people with these kinds of historic ties considered themselves to be real Americans, true Americans. Americans traditionally had welcomed newcomers from such Western European countries as Britain, France, or Germany. But most of the people arriving in New York City and other harbors in the 1920s were from the central, eastern, and southern areas of Europe. Some Americans became afraid of these millions of people arriving at their shores. They worried that the immigrant newcomers might steal their jobs, or they feared the political beliefs of the immigrants.
Pressure to control immigration increased following the World War. Congress passed a bill that set a limit on how many people would be allowed to enter from each foreign country. And the Congress and President Calvin Coolidge agreed to an even stronger immigration law in 1924. Under the new law, limits on the number of immigrants from each foreign country depended on the number of Americans who had families in that country. For example, the law allowed many immigrants to enter from Britain or France because many American citizens had families in those countries. But fewer people could come from Italy or Russia because fewer Americans had family members in those countries. The laws were very difficult to enforce, but they did succeed in limiting the number of immigrants from certain countries.
A second sign of the conservative feelings in the 1920s was the nation's effort to ban the sale of alcoholic drinks or liquor. This policy was known as prohibition because it prohibited or banned alcoholic drinks. Many of the strongest supporters of prohibition were conservative Americans living in rural areas. Many of them believed that liquor was evil, the product of the devil. A number of towns and states passed laws banning alcohol sales during the first years of the 20th century. And in 1919, the nation passed the 18th Amendment to the Federal Constitution. This amendment and the Volstead Act made it unlawful to make, sell, or transport liquor.
Prohibition laws failed terribly from the start. There was only a small force of police to enforce the new laws. And millions of Americans still wanted to drink liquor. It was not possible for the police to watch every American who wanted to buy a drink secretly or make liquor in his own home. Not surprisingly, thousands of Americans soon saw a chance to make profits from the new laws. They began to import liquor illegally to sell for high prices. Criminals began to bring liquor across the long unprotected border with Canada, or on fast boats from the Caribbean islands. At the same time, private manufacturers in both cities and rural areas began to produce liquor. And shop owners in cities across the country sold liquor with little interference from local police. By the middle of the 1920s, it was clear to most Americans that prohibition laws were a failure. But the laws were not changed until the election of President Franklin Roosevelt in 1932.
A third sign of conservatism in the 1920s was the effort by some Americans to ban school books on modern science. Most of the Americans who supported these efforts were conservative rural Americans who believed in the traditional ideas of the Protestant Christian Church. Many of them were fearful of the many changes that had taken place in American society. Science became an enemy to many of these traditional religious Americans. Science seemed to challenge the most basic ideas taught in the Bible. The conflict burst into a major public debate in 1925 in a trial over Charles Darwin's idea of evolution.
British scientist Charles Darwin published his books The Origin of the Species and The Descent of Man in the 19th century. The books explained Darwin's idea that humans developed over millions of years from apes and other animals. Most Europeans and educated people accepted Darwin's theory by the end of the 19th century. But the book had little effect in rural parts of the United States until the 1920s. William Jennings Bryan led the attack on Darwin's ideas. Bryan was a rural Democrat who ran twice for president. He lost both times. But Bryan remained popular among many traditional Americans. Bryan told his followers that the theory of evolution was evil because it challenged the traditional idea that God created the world in 6 days. he accused scientists of violating God's words in the Bible. Brian and his supporters called on local school officials to ban the teaching of evolution. Some state legislatures in the more conservative southeastern part of the country passed laws making it a crime to teach evolution theory.
In 1925, a young science teacher in the southern state of Tennessee challenged the state's new teaching law. The teacher, John Scopes, taught Darwin's evolution ideas. Officials arrested Scopes and put him on trial. Some of the nation's greatest lawyers rushed to Tennessee to defend the young teacher. They believed the state had violated his right to free speech. And they thought Tennessee's law against teaching evolution was foolish in a modern scientific society. America's most famous lawyer, Clarence Darrow, became the leader of Scopes' defense team. Brian and other religious conservatives also rushed to the trial. They supported the right of the state of Tennessee to ban the teaching of evolution. The trial was held in the small town of Dayton, Tennessee. Hundreds of people came to watch. Religious conservatives, free speech supporters, newsmen, and others. The high point of the trial came when Brian himself sat before the court. Lawyer Clarence Darrow asked Brian question after question about the Bible and about science. How did Brian know the Bible is true? Did God really create the earth in a single day? Is a day in the Bible 24 hours, or can it mean a million years?
Brian answered the questions, but he showed a great lack of knowledge about modern science. The judge found Scopes guilty of breaking the law. But in the battle of ideas, science defeated conservatism. And a higher court later ruled that Scopes was not guilty. The Scopes evolution trial captured the imagination of Americans. The issue was not really whether one young teacher was innocent or guilty of breaking a law. The real question was the struggle for America's spirit between the forces of modern ideas and those of traditional rural conservatism. The trial represented this larger conflict.
American society was changing in many important ways during the early part of the 20th century. It was not yet the world superpower that it would become after World War II, but neither was it a traditional rural society of conservative farmers and clergy. The 1920s were a period of growth, of change, and of struggle between the old and new values.
And that's our program for today. Listen again tomorrow to learn English through stories from around the world. I'm Jonathan Evans.
And I'm Ashley Thompson.